Hi, everybody. Before today's episode, I wanted to take a moment to address the events of the past week. What happened in Parkland, Florida, at a school I've had relatives recently attend, was a tragedy, and all of us here at Ursula Major Productions stand ready to help in any way we can. We hope this shooting, as we hope with everyone, serves as a turning point in the debate on gun control. And we wanted to make you aware of a couple dates coming up in the future. A march organized by the same people who brought you the Women's March have organized a march called Enough National School Walkout. That'll take place on March 14th, and it will last 17 minutes, a nod to the 17 lives lost at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Parkland, Florida. Another march, called the Student Walkout Against Gun Violence, will take place today, on Monday the 19th. You can check their social media for more information. And one last one, the National School Walkout has organized a walkout for April 20th with more information to come on their social media. So you can check those things out there. And remember, the fight ahead will be tough, but it will be easier if we stand together. See you there. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Jeanette.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Harriet Tubman.
And I'm going to be talking to you about Vera Brittain.
But before we get to that, you might have noticed a slight difference this week. Allison is off in New Mexico filming Banging Lainey. So our producer, Jeanette, say hello, Jeanette.
Hi.
Has stepped in for her, and we are so excited.
Yeah, if you've listened to our Lady Bits episodes, you might recognize my voice. And if you listen to our other podcast, Bitch With Me, then you will definitely recognize my voice. So,
let's dive right in, shall we?
Yes.
All right. So, Harriet Tubman.
I think I've heard of her.
I'd be surprised if you hadn't, honestly. No, a lot of the things that are in this story are kind of surprising to me. I mean, obviously, I knew about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad and the stories that you hear when you're growing up. And, you know, one of the interesting things from the research that you find is that that's a lot of the public's view of Harriet Tubman, because a lot of us learn about her in elementary school. We learn from kids' books and we learn from all these things. And, you know, there's even some of the research I found that said that, you know, for the longest time, that was kind of the only research that was available, or the only popular media on her was children's books. And so it kind of, not degrades the story, but makes it so that it's
more surface level.
There
so
you go.
I know
that's a good way to say it.
Learning about Harriet Tubman growing up, for me, obviously you learn about the Underground Railroad. I remember specifically the story of her rescuing her supposed daughter. And that's the story I remember. Yeah. But there's so much more to her than that.
Yeah. And she really, truly was a badass bitch.
And what was also interesting, I think, about her story is that immediately while she was still alive, people recognized her importance, which doesn't happen for a lot of the women we talk about.
I mean, let's talk about the fact, I mean, we'll get to this, but she was buried with full military honors.
Yes.
When she was buried.
Her first biography came out while she was still alive in, I think, like 1868 or something.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So she was born, she actually wasn't born Harriet Tubman. She was born Araminta Ross, or she went by Minty. And she was born into slavery in 1820 in Dorchester County, which is in Maryland. She would later change her name to Harriet after she was married for the sake of clarity. And Harriet was actually her mother's name, although her mother went by Rit while she was alive. And they were owned by a couple called the Brodesses, Mary Pattinson Brodus and Edward Brodus. And they had a really big plantation near Blackwater River in Maryland. There's actually a lot of speculation over what year Harriet was actually born. Of course, she was a slave, right? So there aren't exactly the most accurate records being kept. And so it's somewhere between 1820, 1825. And Harriet was one of nine, actually.
Wow.
Now, of course, during this time, I mean, we'll get into, I hope, on future episodes, I want to talk about the history of the slave trade and the history of slavery in America as it comes against women in particular, because I think there is a lot of untold history in that area.
Of course, this is a time when families were split up quite regularly and sold off into different places. And this is what happened to her. And her two of her older sisters were sold. They tried to sell her brother, but her mother actually blocked the doorway and kept them from selling her brother, which really is was a revolutionary act in that time. Yeah. And some people say that this was the moment that kind of sowed the seeds for Harriet's, you know, future rebellions. Now, starting from the time she's 5 or 6, she's hired as a nursemaid for a woman named Susan, and she was ordered to watch this baby as it slept, and if it woke up or cried, she was whipped. And so she was actually carried these scars for a really long time, and so she does that for about 7 years, and then she's put out into the fields. At the age of 12, she's put out into the fields. One particular incident, and it's actually an incident where she gets injured quite badly by by the person who was in charge, the foreman of the plantation, who was trying to go after one of the laborers, one of the day laborers. And Harriet, again, following her mother's example, blocked the doorway from the foreman. And the foreman picked up this 2-pound metal weight and threw it at the guy that he was chasing. And it missed the guy, hit Harriet in the head.
Man.
It gave her seizures and headaches that she would have until the day that she died. I mean, it scarred her literally forever. But what it also did was it gave her visions, vivid visions that she had for the rest of her life. And she actually saw it as the same visions as Moses was getting when God spoke to him and said, save your people.
Yeah.
And so she
was pretty religious, right?
She was very religious. Yeah. Absolutely. As were most of the slaves at the time. Now, in 1844, Harriet marries a free black man named John Tubman. Now, this is a complicated relationship, and you find in a lot of the border states, the southern border states where you have that line, right, the Mason-Dixon line, the terms of slavery and the harshness of the slavery gets a little watered down because you do have the free states so close to you. And so you do see these kind of mixed relationships where you have free people being married to not free people. And it's during this time that she actually officially changes her name to Harriet after they get married. So in 1849, Harriet becomes really ill and Brodess tries to sell her, but he can't find a buyer. And so this goes on for a while and she's praying and praying and praying for him to change his ways. And eventually when she realizes that he's not going to change his ways and she's probably going to be sold, she changes her prayers from, I hope he realizes the error of his ways, to, I hope he dies. And this is the quote. Apparently it was, oh Lord, if you ain't ever going to change that man's heart, kill him, Lord, and take him out of the way. And a week later, he died.
He died.
He died. And Harriet actually later expressed regret for that, especially because afterwards Brodus's widow started selling the slaves after his death, and she didn't want to wait for the family to decide her fate. So she said, there was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I couldn't have one, I would have the other. And so it's then when she makes her first escape attempt, September 17th, 1849, her and her brothers, Ben and Harry, actually did escape. And at the time, they were hired out working for a doctor who owned another really large plantation. And because they were working for someone else, the widow Brodus didn't realize that they had escaped. They just thought that they were off. Now, Harriet actually did use the Underground Railroad as a means to escape. I think there's a misconception that Harriet kind of founded the Underground Railroad or started Underground Railroad.
That's what I thought.
And she didn't. The Underground Railroad was a system of both black people and whites and abolitionists and women who started this system to help people. But it wasn't something that Harriet Tubman started. She just became the best at it.
Yeah.
Eventually.
And I'm going to admit that for a very, very long time as a child, I thought it was legitimately tunnels in the ground.
Oh, me too.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's what they make it seem like.
Absolutely.
Is there like an image of her like walking in a tunnel or something? Because I swear, like my whole life, I thought
it's just like it's ignorance. It's like you hear underground, no one stops to think like, has anyone seen the underground tunnels? Like you'd think that if there were, that they would have survived to this day.
That, and honestly, that's what I was thinking while I was doing, while I was like reading about her. I was like, wait a second. Wouldn't we know about, like, wouldn't that be like a site you could visit?
Yeah, there'd probably be a march or something where you could like, let's take the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, but it's not actually just tunnels.
It's not at all.
Because also that'd be like really easy to find and then they get caught.
Now on this first escape attempt, they actually made it pretty far. Eliza put in a runaway notice, which was a thing at the time where you'd put basically a classified ad in the newspaper and say, hey, my slaves ran away. Can you help me get them back? One of her brothers gets cold feet and actually has them all go back. So they all go back together. And then, of course, shortly after, Harriet escapes by herself. She uses the North Star to guide her way. She describes when she finally reaches Pennsylvania, she describes the feeling as, when I found I had crossed that line, I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came like gold through the trees and over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven. After she was free, Harriet then took on the task of helping other slaves escape Maryland via the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
She went back several times and eventually saved over 70 people, 70 slaves
crazy.
She escorted through it. And so this is where we get to like write her seminal thing, the thing that everyone knows about her. And what I didn't know is that, one, she carried a gun while she was helping these people. And it wasn't just to keep the slavers at bay or to keep the dogs at bay. It was for the people she was helping as well. She'd say, look, if you're going to turn back, I'm going to shoot you because you have knowledge that that'll give all of this away.
You're going to compromise this whole situation.
Exactly.
You're
going
to get us all caught.
You're going to be free or you're going to die.
Yeah. That's what she said. Liberty or death.
Liberty or death. Exactly right. The other thing I didn't know is that she got the nickname Moses. One, because she was helping lead people from the promised land to the promised land. But also two, they used the song Go Down Moses as a signal for people to know when it was safe to go and to know when it was free to move. And the song Go Down Moses actually became synonymous with Harriet Tubman. And black regiments during the Civil War later, this is about 10, 15 years later, would actually sing it. And performers in blackface added it to their routines, which helped, to popularize it.
That's incredible.
So things get complicated. In 1850, Congress passes something called the Fugitive Slave Act. And it's actually a Fugitive Slave Act that makes the one that had been passed previously even worse than what was already in place. And essentially what it did was it said, if a slave escapes from a slave state and makes it to a free state, that does not make them free. And it authorized the law enforcement of those states to help in the rounding up of the slaves and returning them.
Yeah.
Does it not sound exactly like what's happening in our country today? I mean, not to get too political, but I mean, so over the course of this time, she helps her parents escape, which is kind of an amazing feat, given the fact that both her parents were over 70 years old at the time. She helps her family escape. She goes back and tries to save her husband, John, and she finds that her husband has taken a second wife and actually is like, oh, I kind of like it here. I don't want to leave. And
so crazy.
There's a story where Harriet made the decision. She almost went and like caused a scene in the house and was like, but she didn't. She just went and found other slaves and helped them escape instead. She was like, okay, you're not going to take the opportunity. I'm going to give the opportunity to someone else, someone who deserves that.
So crazy.
Isn't that not crazy?
Like, she shows up. She's like, okay, let's go. Like time to go to Canada. Here we go. And he's like, wifed up someone else.
Kind of comfortable. Exactly.
I enjoy it here. I'm good.
One of my favorite quotes about Harriet Tubman talks about this time on the Underground Railroad. It's actually from Frederick Douglass.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, excepting John Brown of sacred memory, I know of no one who has willingly encountered more perils and hardships to serve our enslaved people than you have. And he said that to her, to her. By 1856, she had a bounty on her head worth $40,000.
Really?
Yes. The bounty had increased. It started at, I think, a couple $100s.
Yeah.
And eventually it was raised to its highest point to $40,000.
Did they know
that she was
the one who was leading slaves away?
I think they did. Yeah. At first they thought it was John Brown.
Oh, okay.
And then I think they figured out it was her. And there's an interesting story where she was in a pub or a bar. Or she was in public somewhere and she saw two guys reading her wanted poster. And she knew that her wanted poster said that she was illiterate. And so she picked up a book and pretended to be reading. And that was enough to fool them into thinking that it wasn't her.
Wow.
Harriet Tubman never, in the 13 missions that she went on, in the 70 people that she brought, never lost one person.
That That is incredible.
Never once. And she's quoted as saying, I was a conductor on the Underground Railroad for 8 years, and I can say what most conductors can't say. I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger.
Simply incredible.
It's amazing. John Brown, who is a man we're going to do a Lady Bit episode on that'll come out either next week or the week after, called her one of the bravest people on the continent.
Whoa.
And John Brown did the raid at Harper's Ferry, yeah, which we're going to talk about.
And just as a reminder, through mm-hmm. all of this, she is having seizures and migraines.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, when I feel any type of discomfort, I'm like, I need to lay down.
I need to go home.
It's, I can't believe she's, like, she's doing all these. She's helping all these people, and she's also having
suffering. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it goes back to a couple weeks ago. We talk about Rachel Carson, who's, you know, writing yeah. these books and doing all these amazing things and dealing with and caring for her ailing mother and yeah. raising the son of the, you know, niece that had passed away.
And she had cancer. And she had same with Juliet Lowe. Juliet Lowe had cancer and just kept going to Girl Scout events.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So 1859, there was a Republican senator named William H. Seward who sold Tubman a piece of land on the outskirts of Auburn, New York. Basically used it for the rest of her life in a couple different ways. It became a haven for her family and friends for mm-hmm. a long time to come. It was eventually named after her when it was turned into a convalescent home
oh.
for older and disenfranchised African Americans. And that is actually where she passed away, on her own land. Right? Isn't that not? That's incredible. Think for me is one of my favorite parts of this story, that she was born into slavery and she died a free woman, a landowning free yeah. woman. There's a lot more that happened with Harriet Tubman. I mean, honestly, just like pretty much every other woman we've covered, more than we could possibly fit into an episode of The Bitchery of History. So yeah. we are going to do a couple lady bits on her.
Yeah.
One in particular where we're going to talk about her work during the Civil War, because she was very active, not only as a nurse, but also as a spy
yeah.
during the Civil War. So definitely stay tuned for that. In 1913, surrounded by friends and family, she died. And before she died, her last words were, I go to prepare a pace for you.
That's beautiful.
She was buried with full military honors at Fort Hill Cemetery in Auburn.
I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, I really only knew the stuff about like the Underground Railroad. I had mm-hmm. no idea that she was active in the Civil War. Oh, she fought yeah. in the Civil
she
War.
She fought. Yeah, she led raids during yeah. the Civil War.
And I had no idea that she worked with Susan B. Anthony. Like mm-hmm. her legacy spans so much more than just the Underground
Absolutely.
Railroad.
Absolutely. One last honor for her.
Mm-hmm.
On April 20th, 2016, it was announced that she would replace Andrew Jackson on yes. the $20 bill.
Oh my gosh, that was the best. Because
absolutely.
He's got to go.
He's
that was wonderful.
Yeah, so that's Harriet Tubman. Again, there's a lot that we're going to talk about in Lady Bits. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about Vera Brittain.
Please.
Are you ready?
I'm strapped in.
Okay, so Vera Brittain, one of my favorite women of history ever. She is the author of the book A Testament of Youth, which is a memoir she wrote after World War I. It's considered the first book written about World War I from the perspective of a woman.
Oh, wow.
And just to start us off, here's a really great quote that I think shows exactly where her mindset was during that time. She said, quote, in the churches of Oxford, where so many of the congregation are soldiers, we are always having it impressed upon us that the call of our country is the call of God. Is it? I wish I could feel sure it was. At this time of the year, it seems that everything ought to be creative, not destructive, and that we should encourage things to live and not die.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Get ready for some truly amazing quotes.
Okay.
In this story. So Vera was born in Newcastle and was the daughter of Thomas Arthur Brittain and Edith Brittain. She had one younger brother. He was 2 years younger than her, and they were very, very, very close. And her father was a paper manufacturer, so they were middle to upper middle class. Yeah. My favorite way to describe Vera, to really put her in context, is for anyone who's a fan of Pride and Prejudice, Vera Brittain is the real life embodiment of Elizabeth Bennet.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah.
during World War I.
Okay.
So if you can imagine what Elizabeth Bennet would be like during World War I, very similar to Vera Brittain. So her family moved twice during her childhood. And starting at the age of 13, she started attending a boarding school at St. Monica's in Surrey. It was an all girls school. So that's where she went and got educated. And that is also where she kind of encountered feminism for the first time. It was during the suffragette movement and at the turn of the century. And so she knew this was happening in London, and it made her very excited. And she had always had those inklings of feminism in her. And in her book, she recalls this time when she was about 11 and she was walking down the street. She walked past her brother's school and he was out at recess with his friends. And so she stopped at the fence to talk to him. And her mother and her aunt went by and saw that she was talking to boys, and they scolded her for it later. And they're like, you cannot talk to boys in public. That was a huge thing. And she remembers thinking at the time, even when she was 11, how absurd it was that boys and girls were educated separately. And she made a vow to herself then that if she were to ever have children, they would receive a co-ed education. So pretty crazy for an 11-year-old who doesn't, who only knows the separate.
And pretty forward thinking for the early 20th century.
Yeah. So fast forward to post, it's not high school, and it's not finishing school, post education, beginning education. Vera decides she wants to go to Oxford to study English literature. So Oxford has a couple girl schools. So she wants to go to Somerville, which is the hardest school to get into. And even though Vera was educated, she didn't have like a private tutor, which is, if you were a higher class, that's what you had. And those were usually the girls that were going to college. But she was adamant on this, and her father did not want her
to
go.
That's so disappointing, because so often we praise all of the fathers on this podcast
he comes around.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, all right.
And her parents are as supportive as they can be for the time. I mean, it is a different time.
Sure, absolutely.
But he was very concerned that she would never get married if she stuck to books, and she didn't care about getting married because she just wanted to write, and she wanted to have a career as a writer, and she knew that her whole life. And so what finally changed her father's mind was two things. One, a family friend came over for dinner, and this family friend was bragging about how he had two sons who were both going to Oxford. And so Vera's father, trying to one-up him, was like, oh, Edward's going to Oxford, and Vera's been thinking about it too. So that kind of planted the hope in her that, oh, maybe I can go. And then finally it was Edward, her younger brother, who said, I'm not going if she's not going.
Oh, good. Yeah. Edward.
Edward's amazing.
Praise to Edward.
And her father couldn't stand the humiliation of his son not going to Oxford. So he agreed.
Okay.
Unfortunately, right before they were both supposed to start school is when World War I broke out. So Edward had been going to an ROTC type school and had rudimentary military training. But him and all of his friends were supposed to be going to Oxford. And then during that summertime between school years, that's when the war started. And so Vera left for Oxford and Edward did not. He enlisted, and Vera actually had a fight with her father to let Edward enlist.
Wow.
Because it was seen at the time, at the start of World War I, like, you have to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And Edward's father did not want him to go because he knew what war was. He knew the reality. He didn't want to lose a son.
Yeah.
But Vera and Edward fought with him so much that he allowed him to enlist. And also his friends who were a little bit older than him were also all enlisting. And so he felt a little left out. So Vera stayed in Oxford for a year, but then she felt like she couldn't focus on her work, and we'll get to more why in a minute. So she left Oxford to become a nurse, a voluntary aid detachment nurse, a VAD. So she worked as a nurse in Buxton and then London, Malta, and France.
Wow.
So she went all over the
place.
She
traveled quite a bit.
Yeah. She wrote this even before the war had directly really affected her life. She wrote, quote, "It is impossible to find any satisfaction in the thought of 25,000 slaughtered Germans left to mutilation and decay. The destruction of men as though beasts, whether they be English, French, German, or anything else, seems a crime to the whole march of civilization." So that was at the start of the war.
Amen.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
So like I said, she and her brother were incredibly close. And because she was such a modern woman for the time, she didn't have a lot of female friends. And so her friends were her brother's friends. And two in particular, Roland Leighton and Victor Richardson, were the Edward, Victor, and Roland were called the Three Musketeers.
Oh, okay.
And then another boy named Jeffrey became very close to Edward during the war. And then Vera, by approximation, became very close to him as well.
Okay.
So Vera and Roland developed a romance. and they eventually would get engaged. But the first time that they ever met, she thought that he didn't like her at all because she's like very sassy and like speaks her mind. Mm-hmm. And he seemed kind of standoffish of that. And so I want to read a poem that he wrote after the first time they met.
Please do.
And especially keeping in mind, one, she thought that he did not like her. And two, she didn't see this poem until later after the war.
Okay.
Okay. I can't pronounce it. It's called Nachkling, which I don't think is German. Nachkling? I don't know. I don't know what the title means. It says, down the long white road we walked together, down between the gray hills and the heather, where the tawny crested plover cries. You seemed all brown and soft, just like a linnet. Your errant hair had shadowed beams in it, and there shone all April in your eyes. With your golden voice of tears and laughter softened into song, does aught come after life, you asked, when life is labored through? What is God and all for which we're striving? Sweetest skeptic, we are born for living. Life is love, and love is you.
Oh my God. Life is love, and love is you.
He wrote that after the first time they met.
I'm gonna weep.
Oh man. So yeah, get ready. Cool thing about Roland, mm-hmm. he actually was a feminist. He described himself as a feminist because at the time his mother was a writer and she was a pretty well-known writer. And it was pretty rudimentary understanding of feminism, but he said that he understood where the money in his household was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, he considered himself a feminist. He wanted his mother to have the same rights as his father because she was okay. the breadwinner,
right.
essentially. And he also wanted to be a writer as well, as we can tell from that poem. He was very, very gifted. And the letters that Vera and Roland wrote to each other, and also the letters she wrote to Edward and Victor and Jeffrey, were all published in a book called Letters from a Lost Generation that came out after a war.
Okay.
Roland, Victor, Jeffrey, and Edward were all killed during the war. They all met very, very sad ends.
She didn't see that
ends.
Poem until after he died.
Until after he died. Ugh. Roland and Vera only saw each other for 17 total days. And they were engaged. And the day before Christmas Eve, he was supposed to come home from leave. And he was killed by a sniper fixing wire in a trench.
Oh my God.
Really sad.
He died the day before he was supposed to come back.
Mm-hmm. This is another quote from a letter he wrote her, and this is one of the like more well-known quotes from her book and the letters between them. He said, quote, "But I am coming back, dear. Let it always be when and not if. As yet, everything is incomplete, but last night, unreal as it seems to be, must have some consummation. The day will come when we shall live our roseate poem through as we have dreamt it." It's truly, I just have to say, if you are a hopeless romantic, you have to read this book, Testament of Youth. It is so beautiful. The letters and poems that the two of them wrote each other are truly on another level.
I'm going to cry.
It's incredible. And it's very sad. They only saw each other for 17 days. And then Victor, her brother's friend, was shot in the head and blinded. And they thought he was going to pull through. And then he died. And then Jeffrey, another one of her brother's friends, also died. And then Edward eventually died much later in the war in Italy. And Edward was actually, no one thought Edward would rise to any type of military prominence, but mm-hmm. he actually became a captain and he received the military cross.
Oh, wow.
So he got to meet the king and the king thanked him for his service.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He was shot before he died. He was shot twice. He was shot in the thigh and shot in the stomach. And he survived. And even though after he'd been shot, he still was leading his men on a charge through no man's land. And so that's how he received the military cross. So after the war, Vera found it very difficult to adjust to life in post-war England. Even during the war, she tried to go back to Oxford at one point and she just couldn't do it. She couldn't bear it. She thought everything that other girls were talking about was very trivial because of all this death that was happening. But she did meet Winifred Holtby, and the two of them would become best friends, and Winifred also became a very influential writer. In 1925, Vera married George Catlin, who was a political scientist, and they had two children. They had a son, John, who would become an artist, painter, and author of an autobiography called Family Quartet, which is about their family. And then they had a daughter named Shirley, who would actually grow up to be the Labour cabinet minister. And wow. She started the Social Democratic Party in the UK in the 80s.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. So her daughter came up to rise to prominence. So Vera published Testament of Youth in the 30s. And that was really what charred her to fame. The book sold out in the first day. Every printed copy sold out in the first day. And it sold 120,000 copies in the first 6 years. And her daughter is the one who described it as the first book about World War I that was written by a woman.
Yeah.
And Vera thought it wasn't going to get a lot of attention because she wrote it after the heyday of the war. She wrote it several years later, like 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But because this perspective hadn't been seen, and the focus on the book is the loss of life and the fact that this whole generation of young men was basically wiped from the earth, and this whole generation of young women lost their youth and their happiness very early on because they all had to face this destruction of humanity.
Yeah.
So the book is very heart-wrenching, but that's kind of what launched her career. And after the war, she became a very passionate pacifist and pretty well-known pacifist. She joined the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she advocated against World War II, which is a very unpopular thing to do at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But she was what was considered a practical pacifist, meaning that she advocated against war. But when war happened, she showed up. She did her part. She was a fire warden during World War II.
She understood the necessity sometimes of it.
Yeah. And she raised money for food for the troops during World War II.
This is the second pacifist we've had from World War II.
Janet Rankin. Mm-hmm. She was the only person to vote against going to war.
Yep.
So then in 1966, Vera suffered a really bad fall in London on her way to a speaking engagement. And she still attended the engagement and spoke, but afterwards she found out that she'd broke her arm and one of her fingers.
She did the whole thing without realizing her arm was broken. Yeah,
or she just ignored it.
Right.
And then that...
Because bitches get stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. We fight through the pain. But that fall marked the beginning of the physical and mental decline for Vera from that point onward, and she suffered from motor neuron disease.
Oh, okay.
Vera died in Wimbledon on March 29th in 1970 at age 76. In her will, she requested that her ashes be scattered on her brother Edward's grave in Italy. She wrote in her will, quote, "For nearly 50 years, much of my heart has been in that Italian village cemetery."
Oh, I just got chills.
Yeah. And her daughter honored her request. You should read this book. Highly, highly recommend it. It's 600 pages long, so if you don't have the time, if you're not in the mood, thankfully there is a movie called Testament of Youth. Came out in 2014 for the commemoration of World War I. It stars Alicia Vikander as Vera Brittain and Kit Harington as Roland.
Whoa.
And Taron Egerton as Edward. It is such a good movie. It is so beautiful. And if you're a fan of Pride and Prejudice, I really could not recommend it enough. Mm. The two are very, very similar.
You know I am.
Yeah. And her daughter actually gave the okay on the movie.
Oh, cool.
And like talked to Alicia Vikander beforehand. And
so it's an authorized.
Yeah.
It's an authorized movie.
Yes. And it's a great adaptation. But yeah, so that's Vera Brittain. I love her. I love her writings.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to look that up.
Yeah. Here's one last quote from her. This is about Roland. She said, quote, "I never think definitely of him as a man or boy, as older or younger, taller or shorter than I am, but always of him as a mind in tune with mine, in which many of the notes are quite different from mine, but all are in the same key." It's like the best love story ever.
They met 17 times.
Yeah.
And they were engaged.
They were engaged. It's truly remarkable. And and her writing style is very, very incredible.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, friends. It's Allison here. Well, I'm not here. I'm actually in New Mexico filming my movie, Banging Lainey. And that movie is what gave birth to this podcast years ago. Max and I chatting about it. And I'm so, so excited that he has helped me so far. And you listeners have helped so much in making this movie happen. And that means 2 episodes this month. There's going to be some special guests with Max. And if you are enjoying this podcast, if you want to help more awesome movies happen made by women, supporting learning about women, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. You get access to the contributors blog. I'll probably throw up some behind the scenes photo from our film there as well. Check it out. $1 a podcast, $2 a podcast, $10 a podcast. Can do it all at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. If you're not able to donate financially, I totally understand. I'm working for free for a month in New Mexico. But what you can do is just look down at your phone, your computer, your tablet, your Google Glass, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. I can't wait to come back and talk to you all in March. Thank you.
All right, so on Bitch With Me, we talked about the Grammys and we talked about award season and going into award season.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be interesting and helpful for us to talk about why award seasons matter and why they don't.
Yeah.
So I was wondering right off the bat what your take is.
Well, for starters, I'm like an award season junkie, specifically for movies and TV, because that's what the majority of what I consume. I'm not a huge fan of the Grammys, but I do like, I'll watch all the performances and like the speeches and stuff. Sure. And I'm interested in who's winning, but I am an award season junkie. Growing up and knowing, I knew from a very young age I wanted to work in film. And so growing up, I put a lot of merit in these awards and like, these awards are the movies that matter. And then I watched the movie Crash and I was like, wait a minute.
Something's not adding up.
Crash won Best Picture. And I could not dislike
kinda
that movie.
Kind of surprised everyone
more.
When it happened too.
Yeah. And that was when I really started to think more deeply about these award shows. And now even more in the past few years, the things that are getting awarded are not necessarily all the things I feel like we're always having a cultural conversation about. And so in that way, I feel like they're out of touch. And I've really started to realize this term of like the Hollywood elite and like where it comes from, in the sense that it seems like we're having our own separate conversation about movies and shows in Los Angeles or in New York or in major cities, because we have the access to them.
And absolutely.
And especially with the Golden Globes, the Golden Globes happen right after the cutoff date of when movies can be accepted for awards. So a lot of the movies that are getting awarded for the Golden Globes aren't even out yet for the public. Like, and so it's not fun.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
It's not fun to watch award shows for movies you haven't seen.
Right. Yeah. I think I'll agree with you in that it is kind of like we're asking the wrong question, because I do think that the award shows matter in that giving movies awards helps to spread ideas further than they might otherwise get to, you know. It gives movies like Moonlight a platform that they might not have, you know, despite all the kerfuffle with the, you know, mistakenly calling it whatever. But it does give movies platforms that they might not other. It gives you that sticker. And a lot of times if someone isn't willing to go, oh, I'll give this movie a chance, you know, just from the cover, they'll see that Academy sticker and they'll go, oh, okay, well, maybe there's something to that and I should watch that. So in that way, it really is quite a fundamental, you know, platform that really, really can be used for a lot of good. But at the same time, it's like they don't matter, because when you're saying that this is the best of something, or you're saying that this is the best actor or best this or best musician or best that, you have to remember that these are being voted on by people. And they're being voted on by members of the Academy who, you know, might not necessarily have watched all those screeners that they were sent. A screener, if you don't know, is a copy of the movie that's being up for consideration that gets sent essentially to every single member of the Academy. So for example, and if you are in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, when 12 Years a Slave was up for the Oscar, the company that made it, I can't remember the production company at the moment, would have sent a copy of 12 Years a Slave in a very nice package to every single voting member of the Academy, saying, for your consideration, here's all the things that we're up for. Which adds to your point. It's like where, you know, you have these the Hollywood foreign press where they're judging movies that aren't open to the public, it's because they're being sent the movie by the companies themselves.
Oh yeah, I have a lot of screeners.
And so these people are they're fallible, right? Like, you can't, one, you're talking about cultural things. We talk about the Grammy. I would like to see, when Grammy voting was open, combine it, overlap it for when Bruno Mars released that song with Cardi B.
Oh yeah.
Because that thing blew up.
Yeah, that song's
because
great.
I mean, rightfully so. It's a great song. But you know, that very much so could have swung the voting in his direction.
Yeah. Right? That's true.
No one was expecting Bruno Mars to win.
And obviously the Academy is not representative of our nation.
Absolutely. It's also very true.
In any way, shape, or form. It's even though in the past years, after Oscars So White, which was started by a black woman on Twitter, April Rain, even after that, and they added a lot more members to the Academy, it still is predominantly white and male.
Absolutely.
I feel like this year, and I talked about this on Bitch With Me, that the movies that I was having the most conversations about, or that I felt like we as like a culture, society, were having more conversations about, aren't necessarily the movies that are going to get awarded.
For example,
well, Get Out did get awarded, but it was speculated for a long time that it wasn't going to get any awards. I felt like that was the biggest cultural movie of the year.
Absolutely. What a comment on society.
Yes. And it'll be amazing if it wins. I really hope it does. I'm pulling for it. Wonder Woman didn't get any awards.
I'm still aghast about it.
It, which I thought was a huge movie. It was a huge success.
Yeah.
Probably the most fun I've had watching a movie in a movie theater in a long time. I freaking love that movie.
Yeah. Talk about Wonder Woman and It, two genres of movies that generally do not do very well.
Yeah.
At any award shows, superhero movies and action movies, or
horror movies,
generally don't do well at these. And I think it's because there's like a stigma against them. Like, there's a big portion of the Academy that still thinks, oh, well, this isn't auteur cinema. This isn't real theater. And it's like, what does that even mean? You know what I mean? Like, if a movie is good, Wonder Woman was fantastic. Wonder Woman changed the paradigm for how superhero movies will be made going forward. Every single movie going forward will be compared to Wonder Woman.
That's true.
It'll be set as the standard.
Oh, and the other movie I was thinking about was Girls Trip. Was huge.
Yeah.
Huge conversation. Didn't get any awards. And as Jada Pinkett Smith revealed on Twitter, it didn't even get consideration. Like, they didn't even send out the screeners for Girls Trip, at least for the Golden Globes.
Right.
And I think that's such a shame, because that movie was huge. Yeah. And also, that movie is hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's not uncommon of the Academy to award comedies, because Bridesmaids got nominations. The Hangover got nominations. And so I think that goes to show more of like...
Devil Wears Prada was nominated.
Yeah, exactly. That goes to show more of like the Academy body of who's voting.
Absolutely.
Because if that was... I feel like if it was our generation, Tiffany Haddish would win an Academy Award.
You know
what I mean? I keep seeing people that are like, oh, no good movies came out in 2017. I think that's bonkers.
I completely agree.
Wonder Woman, It, Logan... Girls Trip, Lady Bird. Oh my gosh. Phantom Thread. I haven't seen it yet.
It's good.
So many good ones.
Absolutely.
Not Proud Mary.
All right. So I guess in closing, have fun. Watch the Oscars. Watch your Golden Globes. Watch your Grammys. Watch your Tonys. But like, they're not the end all be all.
Yeah.
Clap and have fun and then move on.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. So, cause of the week
is going to be the Red Cross, in honor of Vera Brittain, because that is the organization that she worked for as a nurse. And so the Red Cross, if you haven't heard of it, Red Cross volunteers and staff work to deliver vital services, from providing relief and support to those in crisis to helping you be prepared to respond in emergencies. So they have played a huge role this past year in all the natural disasters that we've experienced, the hurricanes in Puerto Rico and in Texas, and earthquake in Mexico. I donated to the Red Cross for the earthquake in Mexico this year.
Yes. There has been some criticism in the past for things that have happened in previous hurricanes for the Red Cross. But they are still an amazing organization, and they deserve your support.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Where can we find them, Jeanette?
Redcross.org.
Awesome. Well, Jeanette, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you on for this having
episode
me.
Of History.
Hope I filled the shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh, you did very
this
much
is so.
So
nerve-wracking.
If you haven't been looking at the description on the podcast, Jeanette has been a producer here for a year and a half, along with Kim as well.
Yes.
If you'd like to keep in contact with her, you can find her handle at
Neddie94, N-E-D-D-I-E 94.
Perfect. You can find me at M-A-X-E-E-K Maxi-K. You can find the Bitchery of History at Bitchery Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at the Bitchery of History. And you can find us on patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Yeah, we're also on Facebook under the Bitchery of History. And we have a website, umpboh.com.
If you don't listen to Bitch With Me, we're going to take a second to plug it right
yeah.
here. Bitch With Me is a lot of fun. It's me and you, Jeanette, and our other producer, Kim, who's going to be on next week
yes.
as my guest host. And we literally do what it sounds like.
We bitch.
We bitch, yeah. A huge shout out to the team.
To the team!
To the team. Thank you, Allison, who's in New Mexico filming Banging Lainey.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Sydney.
Thank you, Jess.
And thank you, Jeanette.
Thank you, Max. Thanks for having me here, guys.
Of course. And as always,
bitches get stuff done.